from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro. Coming up on Forum, police have the go-ahead from the U.S. Supreme Court to swab for DNA whenever they arrest someone. They don't have to wait for a conviction. California is already building a massive DNA database. Some call it genetic surveillance and a threat to our Fourth Amendment rights. Others say DNA can help keep innocents out of prison, presuming other parts of the law enforcement system are working the way they should. Forum is next. After this. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro and today for Michael Krasny. This hour, we explore what the Supreme Court's decision on DNA testing means for California. With a 5-4 decision, the highest court in the country said police may take DNA samples from people arrested in connection with serious crimes. Split as it was, this ruling affirms policy in more than 25 states, including California. Can we now expect to solve a huge number of cold cases, or are we romanticizing the possibilities based on watching too much TV? Can we hope science will help free those wrongly convicted, or will this technology simply be used to solidify systemic racism? Joining us now to answer these questions are Erin Murphy, a law professor at NYU Law School, and by phone, Larry Rosenthal, a law professor at Chapman College and former federal prosecutor, and Hank Greeley, director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences and a law professor at Stanford University. Erin Murphy, as you're in studio today, I thought I'd start with you to get a reaction on what Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote for the majority. A cheek swab of the arrestee's DNA is like fingerprinting or photographing, a legitimate, as he put it, police booking procedure that is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. Your thoughts?
Good morning. Well, I think that is the big question that everybody has on their mind. Isn't this just a 21st century fingerprint? But I think that to analogize it to a fingerprint is to make two fundamental mistakes. First, we know it's not a fingerprint. We don't have the National Protection Against Employers Getting Your Fingerprints Act, like we do a Genetic Protection Act and Discrimination Act. We don't worry when we leave our fingerprints places that some sensitive information could be exposed. We don't send our fingerprints off to learn about our family histories or have fingerprints, .com to connect ourselves to long-lost relatives and so forth. Our genes are different. The second thing is that fingerprints have been used, obviously, for a long time in this country for identification purposes. But that was their purpose, identification. They've been never used as a primary purpose of solving past or future crimes. And we know that by intuition. When we open up the newspaper, we don't see that a fingerprint that was taken from an arrestee at booking has solved a 30-year-old cold case, whereas again and again we see those stories about DNA. And so I think what we learn is that DNA actually is quite different. The primary purpose of collection of DNA from arrestees is to solve past and future crime. It's not to do what we do with fingerprints, which is establish the identity of the offender. In fact, if we were going to do that, there's an easy way to use DNA to do just that, which is take a DNA from an arrestee, swab them, check the sample, put it into a database of known offenders, check their identity against that database, and once you've confirmed it, destroy the sample, end of story. Instead, what we do is something very different. We collect the DNA. We often take months to process it. We put it into not just a known database, but also an unknown crime scene sample database or compare it to that database. And then we look for whether there's any matches with unsolved crimes, and we keep it in perpetuity so that every week it can be searched for matches to unsolved crimes. We've never done that. We haven't done that for 100 years with fingerprints. It makes DNA very different.
Hank Greeley, let me let you jump in here. What is your take on this?
First, thanks for having me on the show, and I'm sorry I'm going to have to leave a little bit early. I actually think this is a pretty close call. The decision doesn't strike me as outrageous, and a contrary decision would also, I think, have been quite reasonable. I do disagree somewhat with Erin. Genes are different from fingerprints, but DNA, as used in the forensic system, really isn't different from fingerprints. The 13 CODIS loci, the 13 particular markers that are being used for identification are really only good for identification. And if the federal government really wanted to get all of your DNA, it wouldn't have to worry about going through the database. It could have somebody follow you around and pick up your discarded Coke cans and so on. The other interesting issue here is about the primary use of DNA. And I think Aaron is right that the primary use of DNA is different from the primary use of fingerprints. And yet fingerprints have sometimes been used to investigate past cases or to identify people with past cases. And the DNA is sometimes used and is likely to be used more often in the future for things other than just looking at cold cases, things like helping to make bail determinations. So I think the question's a little bit closer than Aaron puts it.
Well, let me get Larry Rosenthal to jump in here. Larry, California is already allowing police to collect samples from anyone arrested for a felony. Is anything going to change in California as a result of this Supreme Court decision?
No, it's made clear, however, that an earlier decision by the Court of Appeals out here in California upholding the California system is going to stand. The California system has solved over 10,000 open cases by identifying the DNA of offenders. What Professor Murphy talks about sounds to me like a pretty good result. We get a system where we can solve a lot of very serious crimes that went unsolved for years. That sounds like a good thing to me, not a bad thing.
Professor Murphy, what do you say to that?
Well, so first of all, I'm not opposed to sampling of convicted offenders. And I think one really important point that gets lost in this debate is that much of what we think we've accomplished, we actually don't have good data, but what we think we are accomplishing with arrestee sampling could probably be accomplished with convicted offender sampling. So, for instance, we don't have really good studies about what arrestee samples have achieved, you know, what kind of cases they've closed, whether those cases could have been solved other ways and so forth. But the sort of anecdotal information we have indicates that almost all or many of the individuals who have been caught in the net of arrestee sampling, or rather who have been linked to prior crimes, could have been linked through crimes with convicted offender sampling, meaning they had prior convictions that would have made them eligible for DNA collection. So the kind of added value is unclear, I think, at best. And when you talk about, you know, a country that has 12 million arrests a year, that we have a problem of plaguing us of backlogs in processing evidence and so forth, I think it's really meaningful to ask not just whether building out larger known offender databases will help solve crime, but if it's the efficient and best way to solve crime. And I've done some work using other established studies that show that, in fact, the better way to solve crime is not to increase our collection of, you know, first-time offender DUIs and so forth profiles, but rather to spend more money and time collecting crime scene samples. The largest known offender database in the world means nothing if you don't have any crime scene samples to compare it to. And yet, homicide is the only crime, really, in this country that there is routinely forensic evidence collected, submitted, and then actually tested.
Well, also rape, though.
Rape is much less than you would think. Rape, for instance, in only 64% of cases, some studies show, was an evidence even collected. And then when you actually ask how many cases that's actually examined, only 19% of those cases get examined. And there's been an estimate that 18% of unsolved rapes, that's something like 28,000 rapes, have forensic evidence, have physical evidence that was never submitted for testing.
And that's true in California or nationally?
This is a national study that looked at several different jurisdictions. In fact, it's been estimated that 40% of these cases, unsolved homicides and unsolved rapes, these are, you know, cases that are open, have DNA evidence that could be tested and just has not been submitted. And so we have really an epidemic, massive problem in this country of lack of resources for trained crime scene investigators, lack of attention to collecting forensic evidence from crime scenes, and then lack of actual submission of that evidence to labs for investigation. When you ask police officers, why didn't you submit it? 44% say, oh, well, there was no suspect in the case, which tells you we need to educate police officers that actually DNA is great at solving crime when there is no suspect in the case. That's when you should submit it. So,
Professor Rosenthal, are we basically talking about vast vaults of information that police departments are collecting with no wherewithal, no capacity, perhaps no intention of being able to explore it and make use of that data?
The resource question is a very serious question. And that's one of the reasons why yesterday's decision, I think, is such a blow for the interests of sound law enforcement. you need two databases. Professor Murphy just gave you half of the story. We need comprehensive databases from crime scenes. And in recent years, officials all over the country have been working very hard in the middle of a recession to find the resources to improve the collection of crime scene forensic evidence, and it has improved in many, many big cities. But the best collection of forensic evidence from crime scenes you can come up with isn't going to work if you don't have an equally comprehensive database from known individuals that you can compare the sample to. If you got a bunch of samples from crime scenes and you don't have a database with names attached to it that you can compare it to, you're not going to solve any crimes. Now, the most efficient way to build that database is by taking the DNA sample from the person at the time of arrest. That's when they're being processed anyway. If you want to maximize your resources so that you can do this efficiently, law enforcement has turned from systems which were originally used of collecting at the time of conviction. It's harder to do because you've got to reprocess people, and instead doing it at the time they're originally processed, at the time of arrest. And that system, we have plenty of evidence, works very well.
Hank Greeley, not all data is equal. I mean, could you have, with a bunch of arrestee DNA samples, basically a mudding of the waters?
I doubt it. I think that both of my colleagues are right. Without more resources in analyzing crime scene DNA, you're not going to get any significant boost in the number of crimes solved. But without a big database of people to match that crime scene DNA to, you're also not going to get a big boost. The resource issue is an important underlying issue. It's not one the court focused on. It's not really a constitutional law issue. I think the computer can go through 30 million DNA profiles as easily as it can go through 10 million. But I do want to note that it can't just be about the most efficient way of collecting DNA or the way that leads to the very best, biggest and best DNA database, or else the government could say everybody has to give a DNA sample. Every baby at birth, or every time you get a driver's license, or every time you sign up for Social Security. Now, I actually think that might not be such a terrible thing, although it's not politically feasible in the short run. But when the Supreme Court is considering, the Supreme Court has to consider some constitutional limitations other than just what's the most efficient way to get this done.
I guess the obvious reason for why people might be uncomfortable with a massive database containing everybody's DNA would be something out of a, you know, not so science fiction movie like Minority Report with Tom Cruise.
Right.
But what would be the benefit of having that from a civil rights perspective?
I think from a civil rights perspective, one thing that does is it means you're not picking on particular segments of the population. Right now, our database is people who have been, or originally it had been people who had been convicted of particular crimes. That's not a segment of the population we're terribly sympathetic toward, but it's also a segment of the population that is racially and ethnically skewed in particular directions. As we expand it to all arrestees, it keeps that racial and ethnic imbalance. If it's everybody, if it's you and me, as well as people we don't know from different communities, we may pay more attention to it, and there's a greater sense of equality. I do think that in the long run, 20, 30 years out, we're likely to head that way, if only because we will all have much more DNA information in all of our medical records, so that DNA will stop being quite such a scary mystery and be a much more routine part of our lives. But making predictions 20, 30 years out is always chancy.
Well, Aaron Murphy, I'm going to ask you to make a prediction 20, 30 years out. Is this the way of all flesh? Is this where it's going?
Well, I think a few things. I just want to respond to a couple points. One is on the universal database. Although I think Hank is right that it would do a lot to give, say, policymakers incentives to make sure the databases are well maintained and properly used, it would have a sort of appearance of fairness and that everyone would have to submit. Apart from it having huge constitutional implications, we've never required people to submit such information to the government as a compulsory matter for law enforcement purposes. We also, I think, have to remember that a lot of policing and the discrimination that occurs in policing doesn't occur just in the sort of identification of suspects. There can be two bar fights, and one ends with the cop saying, "Go home, you drunk college kids," and the other ends with someone being arrested. Or there can be, you know, marijuana enforcement that's different in kind in a public housing project than it is in a college dormitory. There can be a lot of discretion both in the decision to charge and also in the kind of the severity of the charge, the way that the plea bargains are offered, what kind of sentences are offered. That is a level of discrimination and disparity that won't be erased by a universal database. So I think
why not? I mean, it seems like without a universal database, basically investigators would be sifting through the usual suspects.
Well, with the universal database, they still make decisions about what kind of crimes to investigate and pursue. So we know, for instance, in this country that marijuana usage rates are fairly equal among the races. And yet blacks are four times more likely to be arrested and prosecuted for marijuana charges. We know that, for instance, sentences are handed out in a way that show that blacks receive harsher sentences for the same crime, controlling for all other variables about socioeconomics and prior histories of criminal offenses and so forth. And so all of that won't be erased by a universal DNA database. At the end of the day, if certain crime scenes get responded to, if the domestic violence incident in the gated community doesn't have a police response, whereas the incident that is in a lower income community does, then a database isn't going to change that.
And yet if your search pulls up, say, some big political bigwig, you know, the head of San Francisco or San Jose, you might be less likely as an investigator to seek out some poor patsy just because he fits a demographic stereotype to close the case.
Well,
there you are staring at some information that indicates who the real perpetrator is.
Fair enough. Although, remember that no one disputes that when officers have reasonable suspicion, they may take DNA, or when they have – not reasonable suspicion, I should say – when they have a suspicion of some kind, that they can take a DNA sample to confirm or rule out their suspicions. And so in any case where there's a known suspect, someone that, you know, other evidence suggests committed a crime, you can always take a DNA sample and do a comparison. DNA really only comes in handy or is most important in this context when you have no leads, when you have no further information. And let me add to that in sort of the conjecture of the future. One interesting thing about this opinion and a significant difference for California versus Maryland, the state that's law was ruled upon, is that in California, the collection from arrestees has some different features. First of all, the collection doesn't require a judicial officer to validate the arrest. So in Maryland, before they can take the sample, the person has to go before a judge or a magistrate who says, yes, there was probable cause, this is a lawful arrest. That's not the case here in California. It can be done at booking by the police officer. Number two, in Maryland, if the arrest is found to be unfounded or if the case results in an acquittal, the state has to automatically expunge the DNA record and the sample. Whereas here in California, you have to, on your own initiative, petition. So you have to sort of figure out, you know, who to ask and then fill out the forms and get all the proper paperwork and submit it. Maybe you want to get a lawyer if you need to go to court. And so it's a much greater burden. And I think the court's opinion doesn't make clear whether the specific features of Maryland that provide more protection are essential, in fact, to the constitutionality of the law. And there are some indications in the opinion, in fact, that they're not. They refer to the justifications for allowing the typing as sort of a routine booking and talk about the need for law enforcement at the time that someone's taken into custody to learn more information about them, which suggests that you don't have to wait for that judicial determination. That's going to be an open question courts will have to decide. But I think it's an important one, given that, for instance, we know that there's disparity in arrests on a racial and socioeconomic line. And we might think one protection against that would be a judge who comes in and says, I do or don't think there's probable cause here. And we have some anecdotal evidence from the United Kingdom that when they allowed DNA sampling for people who are given what's called a caution, like a warning, that the rate of cautions went up dramatically. The idea being, of course, that law enforcement in trying to decide who to arrest or who to bring into custody might sort of act with be quicker to act or quicker to charge a more serious charge or something that would qualify for a sample.
So there are a lot of examples out there. Professor Greeley, leaving aside for a moment the possibility of a universal database sometime in the future, is there a state or a country that is putting together the right kind of database as you see it, you know, the ideal kind of database others might copy?
Not that I know of. The British database is much bigger than ours. They've been collecting longer for more offenses and more arrests than we have, though they've been slapped down some by the European Court of Justice. There have been some proposals in other countries. I think at one point Portugal talked about creating a universal database. But I think everybody is still kind of finding their way through this. And as Aaron points out, the laws in the United States differ from state to state. I'd also add another difference between California's and Maryland's. California's applies to all felonies. I believe Maryland's only applies to certain kinds of felonies. It doesn't apply to every felony. So in a sense, we've got 50 states and the federal government all serving potentially as laboratories to try to come up with the best kind of collection law.
I'll jump in here and just add that my home state of New York, as well as other states like Illinois and some other ones, have more efficient databases, even though they don't include DNA from arrestees. And the reason is that they, although they're smaller states than California, and so by virtue of having a smaller population to draw from, their convicted offender databases are smaller, they spend much more time and attention on crime scene databases. So in New York, for instance, the known offender database is about 25% the size of California's, but they have 80% as many matches as California. And that's, I think, in part because their crime scene database is 8% larger than California's.
Professor Rosenthal, should we be doing like New York does?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In one of my former careers, I represented the Chicago Police Department. I was in city government in Chicago. And Professor Murphy just referred to Illinois. The Chicago Police Department was intensely frustrated during those years because there was no DNA sampling. And their ability to solve numerous crimes was greatly circumscribed. And it was an enormous source of frustration. We had more unknown samples, but we didn't have a comprehensive database to compare them to. Now, as long as we're prognosticating, I'll offer mine. I actually think that we are in the middle of what could be a very important paradigm shift in privacy law in this country that might be accelerated by yesterday's decision. Traditionally, when we think about privacy law, we only think about it at one moment in the sequence of events, when the evidence is obtained. And we ask, was the government entitled to obtain the evidence or not? And so we now debate, was it constitutional to use the swab inside the cheek of the arrestee to obtain the DNA sample? But what yesterday's decision focuses us on is a different point in the process, because what the court stressed, and I do think this is central to the decision, the swabbing is really not the problem. It takes a second. It's not very intrusive. If you've ever been fingerprinted, it's far more unpleasant and time-consuming to be fingerprinted than to have your cheek swabbed. What the court instead focuses on is how the DNA is then used, and it sustains the Maryland system because there are safeguards to make sure it isn't used for any purpose other than identifying unknown offenders. And I think the
law
is going
I'll have you draw to a close there, Professor. In the next half hour, we'll continue this conversation about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to allow police to swab for DNA whenever they arrest someone. Some are calling it genetic surveillance and a threat to our Fourth Amendment rights. Others say DNA can help keep innocent people from going to jail. What do you think? If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786 or email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Rachel Miro, in today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's recent decision to allow police to swab for DNA whenever they arrest someone. We're joined by Aaron Murphy, a law professor at NYU Law School, Larry Rosenthal, a law professor at Chapman College and former federal prosecutor, and Hank Greeley, director of the Center for Law and Biosciences and a law professor at Stanford University. And we're asking, of course, for your comments and questions. You can call us at 866-733-6786. You can post on our website and our Facebook page, or, of course, you can email us at forum@kqed.org, and that's exactly what people have been doing. Professor Greeley, let me put this first question to you. One listener asked, would any of the guests have any objection to donating their own DNA to the database?
I wouldn't. I don't think it's very important. In fact, I want to pick up on what Larry was ending with in the last segment. I think there are a lot of really interesting privacy challenges right now, mainly as a result of computerization databases and the ability to do rapid comparisons. There is nothing in my CODIS profile and the identifying information in my DNA that's nearly as important to me as my credit card charges or my Google searches or how many times I've crossed what bridge based on my fast track reports. All of that is much more easily available than the DNA information, even under this new decision. So I think we've got big challenges about the conflict between our views of privacy, our expectations for privacy, and where technology is leading us. I think that forensic DNA is only one of the smallest parts of those challenges.
Now, you're imagining, of course, things in the future as they are in the present. There's another listener who writes in, is there any speculation that collected DNA will be used to establish paternity in cases of child support? Might not there come a point in the future where suddenly this information doesn't seem so friendly?
Certainly, even with the CODIS markers now, you can use it to largely establish paternity. You can also use it to determine the identity, if you get lucky, of unknown body remains. So there are some uses other than crime scene uses. They're all identification uses. I think the key here is, do we continue to limit the government use to the identification aspects of the DNA, the so-called CODIS markers or things equivalent to them? If it's only used to match you to a DNA sample or somebody else's DNA, like a baby's DNA, that's one set of issues. If it is allowed to be used more broadly for things like health risks and other inherited traits and so on, then I think it raises bigger issues. Right now, the laws require it to only be limited to these uses, to identification uses. That's something to continue to watch.
Erin Murphy?
Yeah, I think that the identification issue is important because it is true that the laws say for identification uses only, and yet from this opinion we know identification includes criminal history. That's what the opinion said. They also said, for instance, knowledge of identity, this is a quote, knowledge of identity may inform an officer that a suspect is wanted for another offense or has a record of violence or a mental disorder. It might be helpful to protect officers in custody if someone has a mental illness. And that suggests to me that they're at least envisioning that information about someone's mental wellness, someone's behavioral tendencies, that's identifying information, which suggests that under the laws now that say it must be only for identification purposes, don't mean at all that we have to limit it to just these kind of numbers that mean nothing. It could include something like identification of you as someone who's prone to violence or you as someone who has a mental disorder.
Like, why wouldn't you want the cops to know that as they walk into a situation?
Because I think that is the most sensitive and personal information that we have. First of all, we don't have those tests now. So some of this is this 20-year conjecture. But if we were able to develop those tests, I think there's many different reasons why an individual's personal health or mental dispositions are something that they should have control over.
Larry Rosenthal, I hear you jumping to get in.
I think it's critical to be precise about the objection that's being forwarded for any particular use of this information. As I was saying earlier, the swab isn't really the problem, and it's also not a problem for the guilty person. If the DNA exposes someone as a rapist, exposes someone as a fugitive from justice, there's no reason to be concerned about that. That's a good thing, just as when DNA frees an innocent person because it establishes that the suspect isn't the perpetrator. We do need to worry about the use of DNA when it does threaten the interests of innocent people, as when, for example, it's used to pry into your medical history. Now, the reason I think that yesterday's decision is a welcome development is that it's moving the law in that direction. The court, instead of just focusing on the moment that the sample's obtained and saying, was that lawful, it starts focusing on how is the sample used. And I think that moves us in a productive direction.
The court also, though,
Let me just let Hank Greeley pop in here because he's only got just a few minutes left. And I wanted to give Jane in San Rafael an opportunity to jump in with a question.
Hi. I had two questions. The first one was, I think you covered it a little bit, was whether or not right now the markers that they use can illustrate family resemblances, paternity and whatnot, and whether or not that might be a privacy concern just because of the family relationship that might not be public. And second, what effect this will have on statute of limitations for different crimes. I know they're solving old cases, but are people being prosecuted for very old cases? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you so much. Hank Greeley, you want to weigh in on those?
On the family searching, yes, the CODIS markers can be used for family searching. And by family searching, what I mean is to say you find some crime scene DNA, you compare it to the offender database, or now the offender and arrestee database, and say, you know, this DNA from the crime scene doesn't look like Joe Blow, but it's pretty similar to Joe Blow. It might have been Joe Blow's son or Joe Blow's father or Joe Blow's brother. There's been a lot of discussion thus far about the relatively limited uses of this family forensic DNA testing. In fact, Aaron and I were on a KQED forum program about it a couple of years ago, I think. The CODIS markers aren't very good for doing the family assessment, but they can do that. And so finding family relationships and finding family relationships that you didn't know existed, or at least having the police be able to figure out family relationships that the parties didn't know existed, is a concern about the family searching part of this. As to the statutes of limitations and the John Doe warrants, I think maybe Aaron or Larry might be able to speak better to that than I can. I don't know very much about it. Unfortunately, I've got to go teach a class about the Supreme Court's other big DNA case coming up this term, the Myriad versus Association of Molecular Pathology case. So I'm going to have to hang up very soon.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Greeley, for talking with us, and good luck on that upcoming case. Professor Murphy, what do you think? Do you see this challenging statutes of limitations, or is it just information that police will now take into account?
I don't think this case changes much in that regard. When we started collecting offender samples, we had to reckon with statute of limitations. Historically, you know, it's different every state, but historically, most serious offenses like homicide and rape had, you know, open statute of limitations. They ran the they weren't a concern, but sometimes other offenses were. And the way that states have dealt with that is either to extend statute of limitations or to use what Hank just referred to as these John Doe warrants, which is to say indict or charge a profile. It's kind of novel, but indict the genetic profile so that when the match comes along, you're within the statute. And those have been largely upheld. I will say that the fear of having your genetic information in the hands of the government is not, I think, as Professor Rosenfeld suggested, only for criminals. You know, if anyone who's been the subject of a false accusation or who's come under investigation knows that it can be an incredibly draining and financially difficult process. And, you know, we have an example here in California of a man in Sacramento who had his DNA profile in a database by law, who was matched through, a search to a crime scene sample. Police investigated him for the rape. You know, I'm sure he had to explain to his family members why they were charging him with rape. He had to perhaps account for the presence of police at his place of employment. And then it turned out, because he had such clear, irrefutable evidence of his innocence, that they had misinterpreted the sample, because DNA samples from crime scenes, unlike known samples, are very subjective, can be difficult to interpret, often are subject to degradation and other conditions that make them hard to read objectively. And the case that I just referred to, this was a problem of interpretation. Fortunately, he was caught because he happened to have this ironclad kind of evidence of innocence, but not everyone may be so lucky. And so I think even if you at the end can explain, oh, I was innocent all along, telling your neighbors that, no, I'm not really a rapist, that was all a big mistake, is not something anyone looks forward to, criminal or not.
Professor Rosenthal, I suppose that's a risk no matter what kind of evidence links you, inaccurately to a crime.
Well, that's right. As a matter of fact, we now have, as a result of the wave of DNA exonerations that followed the widespread use of DNA evidence, a pretty good database that explains what happens when innocent people are wrongly convicted? It turns out, by far, the leading cause of wrongful conviction is mistaken eyewitness testimony. And it's easy to understand why that happens. Eyewitnesses aren't lying. They think they're identifying the right guy, so juries see them as truth tellers. And because they're often victims or innocent bystanders, they're very sympathetic and persuasive witnesses. But they get things wrong. We don't quarrel with the use of eyewitness testimony. It's necessary. We try to come up with the best safeguards we can, but nobody thinks we ought to bar all eyewitness testimony. But the risk of error in eyewitness testimony turns out to be far greater than the risk of error in DNA evidence. And that, again, is among the reasons why I think the widespread use of DNA evidence is a welcome development, especially from the standpoint of the innocent person wrongly accused.
Well, let's go now to the phones again. Max in Oakland, you're on the air.
Hi. In January of 2012 in downtown Oakland, there was a large protest, and it ended pretty much with police surrounding protesters on both sides in front of the YMCA building and then charging at the protesters, who had no choice but to flee into the building. 80 of the protesters who fled into the building were charged with felony burglary and kept in jail and had their DNA sampled. And the point here is that in cases of political protest, very often police overcharge. None of those charges, almost none, if not absolutely none of those charges were actually followed through with. But all of those people's DNA is going to be in the system indefinitely. And I personally don't think that's just. I'd like to hear some comment from your guests about that. The other thing is data theft happens, and I predict within the next 10 or 15 years there will be a data theft of a government criminal DNA database, and there are consequences to that. And I'd like comment on that.
Professor Rosenthal, you've certainly heard about government computers being breached by hackers all over the world. What's your response?
Well, with respect to data theft, the reason that the markers that are used for this kind of DNA analysis are called junk DNA, this CODIS system, is because they have very little utility other than identification. And for that reason, even if there is a data breach, the problems that will ensue because it's only junk DNA are really very minor. But I want to go back to the example of people wrongfully charged. Now, as it happens, under the Maryland system that was sustained yesterday, DNA is destroyed under those circumstances. You can get a court order to have the DNA destroyed in California. But let's assume that that doesn't happen. Again, I ask, what's the problem? Assume someone is overcharged, ultimately acquitted, and then later they are convicted of rape because their DNA sample remains in the system, and it turns out there's a match to an unknown sample of a rapist. Again, I ask, what's the problem? It seems to me that's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Professor Murphy?
I think this fundamentally comes down to your view of law enforcement. I can tell you one problem exactly analogous to the one the caller raises, which is in New York, there were Occupy Wall Street protests that I think everyone's familiar with. There were DNA swabs as a result of that. The papers splashed, you know, Occupy Wall Street protester linked to homicide through DNA match. Turned out it was wrong. Did the headline, you know, several weeks later say, oops, mistaken, wrong match. No, you know, buried somewhere was, turns out, there was a problem in the processing of the sample and it was erroneous. The same concern is the basis of the California litigation out here, Haskell, that was put on hold for the Supreme Court's decision, where a protester, a political protester, was arrested and swabbed. Those are all cases in which people may have, I think, well-founded reason to fear that the government holding their DNA could result in even false accusations. Not, you know, I agree. It's very hard to get worked up about a serial offender who's caught because their DNA is submitted to a database. But if we believed that the government never made mistakes, we would open our lives to them entirely. We would allow them to read our emails, listen to our phone calls, come into our homes at will. Because what's the harm if the government isn't going to, falsely accuse you? It's only if you've got the dead body in the basement that you have to worry about them looking at your basement. And I think we all know the answer to that is no. In fact, you worry about government incursion on your private life, your private space, not because you're doing something wrong, but because it's essential for us to have those spaces to fully realize ourselves as people.
You know, it's interesting, Professor Rosenthal, that you mentioned earlier junk DNA. It's only junk because we don't understand it now, but we're getting there. And there's a listener who's written on the forum's website, what happens in 10 years when you can buy a spray of mixed synthesized DNA solution and then just spray it all over the crime scene so that there'll be traces of 1,000 different people's DNA?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what happens. If that really occurred, then DNA evidence would use its utility because that's what the burden of proof is about. The prosecution has to prove the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Contamination is already an argument defense lawyers frequently make. If it became commonplace that crime scenes were easily contaminated through methods such as those, the prosecution could never sustain its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Where Professor Murphy and I part company, we're both worried about innocent people. That's why I do think we need to worry about DNA collection systems that could harm the interests of innocent people. But as long as we have a criminal justice system, there's going to be some risk of error. The only way to get the risk of error down to zero is to abolish the criminal law. We need to talk about acceptable risks of error that enable us to enjoy the benefits of living in a lawful, orderly society. DNA evidence in the aggregate, because it has such a low risk of error, especially when compared to the alternative, DNA evidence enhances the reliability of the criminal justice system in the aggregate, and that's why I welcome these developments.
Professor Murphy?
You know, I think that DNA evidence when used in cases with suspicion or with regard to convicted offenders is an amazing and wonderful law enforcement tool. And I think its very effectiveness with those limitations is why arrestee sampling is a misguided direction to go. It's misguided because it takes resources away from processing actual crime scenes for DNA. It takes resources away from the quick processing of convicted offender samples, rapid processing. And it also, I think, fundamentally upsets our constitutional balance. We've never before said that arrest for a crime meant that police could search you for evidence of past or future crime, that it would essentially open you to full investigation. And I think that's what this opinion does, and it's jarring in its scope for that reason. And I will add the familial aspect. You know, many people think familial searching, for instance, is yet another kind of good example of using DNA to solve crimes. And then you say, well, I heard about a case in Louisiana where they did a familial search using a crime scene victim's sample. So someone was a victim of a rape. They had a rape kit done. And then in examining the profile, they realized, oh, you know what? This matches the perpetrator of an offense that we've been looking for. This is close. It's not the victim who's the perpetrator, but maybe the victim's brother or father is a perpetrator. And they use the victim sample to find and arrest someone for an unsolved crime. And I think a lot of people think, wait a minute, I don't want to have to worry if I'm a rape victim about going and having my DNA swab taken and possibly having my brother then picked up for an outstanding burglary charge or having my father go to jail because 30 years earlier, he committed an auto theft. And I think that is a real concern that people are right to have.
Antoine writes in, I think I am most concerned with manipulation of the data and samples. Can the panel address this? Professor Rosenthal, can you see situations where police just go beyond the bounds of their mandate to find a particular perpetrator?
It's certainly possible, but it's much harder to manipulate, to distort DNA evidence than it is, say, the testimony of an eyewitness. There's plenty of data that the police working with an eyewitness can subtly suggest things to the eyewitness that can produce what turns out to be an erroneous identification. So, again, I go back to this notion of risk of error. We've got to make intelligent, carefully calibrated assessments about what the risk of error is for each type of evidence. And I think it is easy to say that when compared to, say, eyewitness testimony, the risk of that kind of manipulation or fabrication is far lower with DNA evidence.
With that, let's go back to the phones and talk to Johan in Richmond.
Good morning. Spellbinding conversation. Mind is humming with questions here. Just a practical, thank you. Practical comment, academic question. Every new power I've seen conferred upon law enforcement is almost always overreached or abused, and there's always a lack of oversight and any enforcement, you know, mechanism to clamp down on those abuses, whether that's stop and frisk in New York or gang curfews and containment in L.A. that turns up being, you know, molding into just racial profiling or cellular monitoring with various devices that are off-market. But my question just revolves around the dissenting opinion, which is odd bedfellows to say the least. I never thought I'd see Scalia agreeing with Sotomayor on anything. Would love to hear the panel's comments on that. But also just the more academic quality of the crux of that dissenting argument. Is it really an assault on the bedrock of the Fourth Amendment, and why or why not?
Fabulous question, Johan. Strange bedfellows on the dissenting side. Professor Murphy, do you want to jump in here?
Sure. To be honest, it's not so strange. Scalia has proven himself to be true to his kind of, you know, view of constitutional interpretation when it comes to criminal justice. And so that's true. For instance, he's an architect of the Confrontation Clause jurisprudence that says that if somebody is accusing you of a crime, they have to come to court to confront you instead of using these hearsay exceptions. He's also been aligned with Sotomayor with the same kind of wing on a number of cases, including a recent case about the use of warrants for blood alcohol tests, you know, for DUIs. And so in some ways it's strange. In other ways, Scalia often sort of is true to the small government interpretation of the Constitution, consistent with the founding perspective. I think his cautions, you know, to take the beginning of your question, you know, in the opinion he says, and I quote, "Today's judgment will, to be sure, have the beneficial effect of solving more crimes. Then again, so would the taking of DNA samples from anyone who flies on an airplane. Surely the TSA needs to know the identity of the flying public, applies for a driver's license, or attends public school." I think the same could be true for other, you know, concerns we have, say Medicare fraud, student loans, and so forth. So I do think that this is very potentially a door opening to DNA being used the same way that Social Security numbers ended up being used. You know, when they were first introduced, there were government assurances. They were only going to be used for this limited purpose, and they would not become general markers of identity. And in this opinion, they say this DNA is an identifier just like a Social Security number, which I think is ironic if you know the history.
Professor Rosenthal?
Well, Justice Scalia is nothing if not faithful to his principles. He's an originalist. He looks to how the Constitution was understood in 1791 when the Bill of Rights was ratified. Now, you may not be surprised to learn that they didn't do much DNA sampling in 1791. That's why I am not surprised to learn that Justice Scalia is not very hospitable toward it. I actually have considerable qualms about whether that's an appropriate approach to constitutional interpretation. I also have qualms about whether it's an appropriate approach if you're concerned about civil liberties. Justice Scalia has never been worried about racial profiling because racial profiling was not a big deal in 1791. I don't expect Justice Scalia to be very sympathetic to claims about same-sex marriage, because that wasn't very popular in 1791. So you do have a deeply rooted jurisprudential philosophy in Justice Scalia, and it's going to produce a particular result when it comes to DNA sampling, but it's not going to consistently enhance civil liberties.
Well, now, Breyer also went with the conservatives.
That's consistent with his behavior. He often in criminal justice cases sides with the conservative wing. And I'll say that the question about whether this is a real landmark case, there's a sentence from the majority that I think tells you it is, which is that the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness, not individualized suspicion. And anyone who watches crime shows knows that, you know, in our culture, we've always thought the Fourth Amendment is about warrants, it's about probable cause, it's about individualized suspicion. And here's the Supreme Court telling us in a majority of five justices, no, it's just about being reasonable.
Is that your take on it, Professor Rosenthal?
Well, actually, it's not, because Justice Kennedy is careful to point out that there is individualized suspicion under the Maryland statute. You can't take a sample unless you have probable cause to arrest the particular individual. But once you have probable cause to arrest a particular individual, a pragmatist like Justice Breyer is willing to look at reasonableness in a broad way. Is the risk of error created by the procedure acceptable? His judgment evidently was yes, and so that's why a pragmatist like Justice Breyer would focus, as I'm suggesting, not on the swab, not on the identification of a criminal, but whether the procedure does threaten the interests of innocent people. And the answer here, I think quite rightly, was given the safeguards in the Maryland statute. There wasn't really anything like an unacceptable threat to the interests of innocent people.
Well, Professor Murphy, do you see this basically expanding options for law enforcement, particularly in California, given that appeals court ruling that was kind of waiting on this decision?
I do. I think the next major question will be, does the appeals court here, does the law in California have to be limited in the same way that Maryland's law was limited? It's not at all clear to me from the opinion that's an essential component, although you could read the opinion that way. So it'll be interesting to see what the court says. Do you have to have this judicial finding? Do you have to have an automatic expungement provision? It certainly also opens an opportunity when law enforcement are making arrests to use their discretion to maybe charge the eligible charge. You know, is this a misdemeanor assault or is this an aggravated assault? You know, I'm going to go ahead and I would have said it's a misdemeanor assault, but I'm going to go ahead now and call it an aggravated assault because if I do, I can take a DNA sample at the station and the prosecutor, when it comes time to actually enter the charges, will knock it down to the misdemeanor when the plea bargain comes along. So I think if you look at the arrest, it'll be interesting to watch the felony arrest numbers in California and see if they raise after this decision.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. So much thanks to our guests, Erin Murphy, law professor at NYU Law School, Larry Rosenthal, a law professor at Chapman College and former federal prosecutor, and of course, Hank Greeley, director for the Center for Law and the Biosciences and a law professor at Stanford University. Thank you all so much for being part of this program. I'm Rachel Miro, and today for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.